The first being loving kindness. And that is the one most talked about. It's the one that, as a technique, as a methodology, usually is the vehicle for all four. Although it is possible to practice each of the four in a more emphasized fashion, you know, slightly different phrases, different sequence, things like that. But most commonly we use the loving kindness phrases and that method to deepen and express all four of these qualities. Loving kindness really is that deep understanding of connection, how our lives are connected, that we live in an interdependent universe, that despite the ways we can have such a strong construct of self and other, us and them, the reality is this kind of interdependence. It's much more of a sense of a fabric of which we are a part, or a network of which we are a part. And there are many ways of deepening loving kindness. Wisdom brings us there. I mean, this is the truth of things, that we live in an interdependent universe. And all the ways we used to feel like, oh, we can tuck that suffering over there, it's never going to affect me over here, or that kind of environmental action or behavior, it'll never affect me over here. You know, we see now in this world, and this is one of the benefits of our world, is that we can see that's not true. What happens over there does affect me over here. And what I do, where I put my energy, it matters because it ripples out. And so it's like wisdom. It's understanding. It's seeing things more as they are. So it's not fanciful. It's not sentimental. It's not forced. It's clarity. It's understanding that brings us there. I like the story I often tell, it's in my book, Loving Kindness, my first book, of this colleague of mine, my friend Sylvia Borstein, who told me this story. She'd been teaching with us in Barry at the Insight Meditation Society. And she got on a plane to fly home to San Francisco, and the plane stopped in Chicago, and then the second leg of the flight went on. So she was on that second part of the flight, when about 45 minutes into it, when the pilot got on the PA system and said, "Now, there's really nothing to worry about, but we've developed a little problem with the hydraulic system of the plane, and so rather than go on and fly over the Rockies without a fully functioning hydraulic system, we're going to turn back. Now, there's really nothing to worry about, and the flight attendants will now instruct you in a position to take in the event of an emergency landing, and they're going to collect all of your shoes and all of your eyeglasses and all of the pens out of your pockets." And I never understood that. And then the flight attendant said to me, "Well, that's what we do in case you have to go down an emergency chute, so nothing like rips or something like that." So there was Sylvia sitting there without her shoes, without her glasses. And she decided she was going to do loving kindness practice. And as you know, it's the silent repetition of certain phrases, simple phrases like "may you be happy," "may you be peaceful," something like that. So Sylvia decided to do loving kindness practice, and she would do it. She was doing it toward the people she's closest to in this lifetime, her husband, her children, their partners, her grandchildren. And when she would get to her youngest grandchild, she would begin again with her husband and just kind of go through the sequence. And Sylvia also said that for some reason the pilot got on the PA system every 5 minutes, and he would say, "We're going to be landing in 40 minutes. We're going to be landing in 35 minutes. We're going to be landing in 30 minutes. And each time he would do that, she would just start with her loving kindness practice again in just the sequence she was doing. And then the pilot got on the PA system and he said, "We're going to be landing in 5 minutes. And Sylvia thought, "In 5 minutes, either I'll be dead or I'll still be alive. And that when she went to go back to do her loving kindness practice, she discovered that she actually couldn't limit it to just those people she was so close to that she loved so much in a personal sense in this life. She found that the only way she could do loving kindness practice with maybe only 5 minutes left to live was toward all beings everywhere, all of life, no one left out. So she did that for 5 minutes. The plane landed. She said it was a landing like any other landing. And they fixed whatever, and she went on. But the reason I've been telling that story all these years is because I love the sense of that moment when she just couldn't. You know, there's nothing forced, nothing feigned, nothing coercive. It's not like she was sitting there thinking, oh, wow. I really don't feel like offering loving kindness practice, loving kindness to everybody in the universe, but I am a Buddhist meditation teacher, you know, and what if anyone ever found out, you know, that I spent the last 5 minutes of my life, you know, just thinking about my grandchildren, so I better, you know. It's like she just couldn't. And we all have those moments, right, when we just can't. We're so hesitant to come forward, and then we know we just have to. Or we really care about somebody, and we know we have to offer what we're offering without strings attached. It's like we just can't be in the ordinary way. We've all been there, where we just can't hold on in the way we once did, or let fear drive us in the way it might normally, or whatever it is, where we know so deeply what's true. And there are times when we just can't deny that or defy it. We just can't. And so what brings us there? Sometimes realizing we might only have 5 minutes left to live brings us there. Sometimes inspiration brings us there. Sometimes suffering brings us there. Where so much falls away. And we think, what is that about, you know? That other, like, concern, obsession, grudge. So many things bring us there. To where we just can't deny what we actually know about connection, about caring, about the power of inclusion. And that's another reason, as I was saying yesterday, why there's something that in the end is kind of natural about loving kindness. It doesn't feel like something, you know, phony or presumed or presumptuous. Natural doesn't mean it just happens, you know, without causes and conditions. But that it's not this kind of superimposition, thinking, oh, I better, you know, act like, is really not like that. And so wisdom of many kinds brings us to that comprehension and that ability to live out what we know. And also practice brings us there. It's not practice in the sense of trying to convince yourself, you know, but it's continually opening a door so that in a lot of situations, that door is much more open than it had been before. We've gotten used to. This is one of the translations or one of the ways that the word in Pali, bhavana, which is usually translated as meditation. The literal meaning of bhavana is cultivation. So we're like cultivating the ground for what we want to emerge, to create the conditions so that it can emerge. So that's what meditation literally means when it's translated, cultivation. But there's in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's a really cute phrase that bhavana, or what we call meditation, is also translated as, which is getting used to it. So when we say meditation, they say, in one particular school, Tibetan practice, they say getting used to it. Or familiarizing yourself with it. So it's in that sense that we're getting used to dwelling in wishing well, inclusion, considering someone instead of ignoring them, paying attention fully instead of in a fragmented way. We get used to that through our practice so that it comes much more readily in all kinds of different situations. So that's why we practice, in effect. Then we have compassion, which is the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. Compassion is also connected in, as ways not fully explored usually, with qualities like resilience, some sense of bigger connection. So there's not, as you know, so commonly happens, a sense of isolation in pain. There's some larger sense of connection. It's connected in some way to a sense of sufficiency, that's the resiliency, what I called inner abundance. So that even quite terrible suffering is not necessarily as shattering as it might have been, where there's some sense of an ability to hang in there with, to be with. And it's a big exploration, like what makes it all too much? What exhausts us? You know, and I think it's a very personal exploration, has to do with looking at balance. You know, do we take a lunch break ever? You know, do we remember to breathe? It has to do with a lot of other elements that perhaps come into the way we look at a situation. Does it have to be me that fixes it today? How devastated am I at just the thought of doing what I can and letting nature take its course? You know, there's a lot to look at and to explore, because compassion has the possibility of being having the nature of lifting us up, joining us together, rather than being as shattering as it so often is. There's a recent study I read somewhere, no doubt via Twitter, saying, interestingly that, and I'm not sure, I'm sure with science how affirmed something is until, years down the road, but the study said something like, doing a compassionate act for someone else is one of the sources for generating more compassion for ourselves. And so I found that interesting, because in sort of like pop psychology, there's a lot about how, well, you have to love yourself completely before you can do something for someone else. And even in the loving kindness practice, where we begin with ourselves, there's definitely an acknowledgement that we can't leave ourselves out, you know, that there won't be that balance ever, you know, if we're just shunned or excluded from our own sense of compassion. So, but I always get hesitant, because people come to me a lot and they say, well, I think I'll just do loving kindness practice for myself until that happy day comes when I've loved myself completely. And then I will turn my attention to others. And I always get a little concerned, because as important as I think it is, definitely important to include oneself, then it becomes a project, you know, with a big agenda. And how do we know, even? that we've reached that place, you know. And so I really appreciated the possibility of this study, that it's so mutual. You know, we do both. And they will reinforce one another. We even start with looking at our own desire and fear and greed and hatred and jealousy in all of those states, and consciously work to make the translation from the way we usually regard those states as bad and wrong and terrible to seeing them as states of suffering, because that's what they actually are. They're states of suffering, and that's the grid within the entire Buddhist psychology. It's not right and wrong and good and bad and good and evil. Usually it's called skillful and unskillful. What's skillful is what is expressive of and leading to the end of suffering. What's unskillful is that which in its own nature is suffering and which is leading us to more and more suffering. So that's different, right? That's a practice all in and of itself. The next time, which could be soon since we're going to meditate, you are looking at some undesirable state within yourself. You know, you're sitting here, you're doing loving kindness, and this great wave of loathing arises. You know, may all beings definitely except you be happy. That's not an easy thing to sit with, right? But as you look at your anger, you look at your fear, you look at whatever, can you make that translation? This is a state of suffering. That's the basis for the development of compassion, is seeing pain as pain. And this too is not, you know, it's not an artifact. This is true. This is a state of suffering. So how are we going to respond to that? The compassion is, you know, it's a very rich and complex, I think quite fascinating exploration. What's the strength in that? What's the joy in that? Being able to reach out to somebody to see if you can make a difference. And then there is sympathetic joy. Having happiness for the happiness of others. They say that of these three states, so far, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, sympathetic joy is often the most difficult of the three. Not always, of course, but quite commonly. The most difficult to develop, which I think is interesting. You know, like, in terms of compassion, we're so blocked often by not seeing pain as pain. You know, we see someone acting in a certain way and it just seems so terrible to us, and we don't often feel into the pain, which is so commonly the source of that behavior. And so, but once we do, we can have a sense of compassion. You know, and there's still a lot of work to do. We can think compassion will lead to weakness, that it won't allow us to take a stand or live in a certain way, you know, with structure, with clarity, with boundaries. And that, none of that is true. You know, so there's a lot of work to do. But the actual eliciting of the sense of compassion, apparently, at least according to some teachers, that will come more readily than sympathetic joy, actually being happy for the happiness of others. Because there are just a ton of assumptions that need to be challenged in order for sympathetic joy to arise for most of us. And again, as I said yesterday, there are obviously people, you know, that we encounter in life who just naturally have sympathetic joy. I find them the most amazing people, you know, like, they just, something good happens for you and they're so happy for you. And it's like, wow. It's such a beautiful thing to receive. And we know the beauty of a quality from receiving it or not. You know, sometimes something really good happens for you and other people are so happy. You know, and it feels so beautiful that they are getting so much fulfillment out of your joy or your, you know, success or whatever. And sometimes really something good happens for you and somebody seems so downcast because of that. Or, you know, it's like they may smile, but you really get the feeling. They would be just fine, you know, if it all fell apart for you. And it feels so bad that they feel somehow harmed by this good thing that has happened for you. So we know the nature of that quality, the power of that quality. For most of us, it's not something that just comes from, you know, background or upbringing or something like that. It's really a training because we do need to look at those assumptions. Assumptions about happiness, that happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for me. Assumptions about permanence. You have everything and you will forever. And I have nothing and I will forever. Assumptions about, you know, and this is what I was referring to. It's this really funny assumption. It's like the prize, the accolade, the success, the good fortune was heading right toward me. And you somehow grabbed it and you got it. And if you hadn't done that, it definitely would have come to me. It was right on its way. I have a friend who is like this baseball fanatic, and she has a glove which she takes to games with her so she can catch like fly balls that somehow come near her. And she told me this story about taking a friend of hers to this baseball game. She had her glove, of course. And there was some very special fly ball that was heading right toward her glove, and he reached out to get it and then deflected it, so neither of them got it. But it was sort of like, how much worse even if he'd gotten it, you know? It was like, but my glove, it was like, is right here. It was coming right at me, right? And that's the feeling that we have. Even though, of course, sometimes we are in direct competition. We've applied for the same grant. We've applied for the same job. If you get it, I don't. Most of the time, it's not like that. But we feel as though it was just like that. And so we feel something's been taken away from me by your success. Whereas the vast amount of circumstances, it has nothing to do with me. Right? And the story I so often tell about, because I do teach this 7-day intensive loving kindness retreat every year in Barrie, in February. And there was one year I was teaching it, and I gave a talk at night on sympathetic joy and this quality of rejoicing in the happiness of others. And I just use this example. I said, it's like Sunday morning and you wake up in New York City and you buy the New York Times and you open it up to the book review section and you open that up to the bestseller list and you see that your friend's book has gotten on the New York Times bestseller list. And you think, ew, it should have been mine. It should have been my book. And not only that, it was gonna be my book. And somehow, it's like the people coming to announce it were on their way to my house, and you distracted them and waylaid them, so they went to your house instead. So it's like you took that from me. Right? So I just used that example. By the oddest of coincidences, I had three friends sitting in that retreat, each of whom had had a book on the New York Times bestseller list. And they each came up to me after the talk and they said, "Is that how you felt?" And I saw my book on the New York Times bestseller list. I said, "No. It just came up. It came out of my mouth. I don't know why. It's just true." But, you know, but it's, isn't it the oddest feeling? And so painful when you think about it. Because look at, I mean, everything is outside of our control, right? So it'd be like every Sunday, you're miserable. It'd be like every day, you're miserable. Or you could be happy. And here I come back to the Dalai Lama in a very homey kind of saying where he says, it only makes sense to develop happiness and the happiness of others because then you can increase your own chances for happiness. Well, at the time he said 6 billion to 1. Now it's 7 billion to 1. And he said, those are very good odds. Just see how much vaster our potential for joy gets when we actually cultivate sympathetic joy. The cultivation means looking at all those assumptions, being able to let go of them, seeing what happens as we wish someone well, remembering compassion. You know, if we look at someone enjoying something, do we really wish they had no happiness ever? And only sorrow? Because sorrow is going to come. Inevitably, it's not through our efforts to bring them down. It's just in the nature of life. We go through joyful times, we go through hard times. That's how things actually are for everybody. Of course, we don't always see that because we don't know a lot of what happens, you know, in someone's life except on the surface. But that's in the nature of things. And so, we also work on cultivating sympathetic joy through cultivating gratitude for what we do have. There's so much that we overlook, even in a very rough time or hard life. There's so much that we overlook, and that just makes things harder. And then just in general, it's a very powerful thing to cultivate gratitude. And this, I think, also points to the nature of effort in a practice or intentionality in a practice like loving kindness or this reflection on gratitude. You know, apparently one of the most psychologically significant things one can do in an ordinary day is keep a gratitude journal. Write down 3 things each night that you were grateful for that day. And this apparently is extremely beneficial. Right? Now I, both in terms of my personal family and cultural conditioning, I am a New Yorker, you know, that wouldn't come automatically. It'd be more like, think of everything that went wrong today and the way everyone, you know, didn't behave properly and everything you complain about, that comes naturally. So it takes some effort. Right? I have to sit down and say, oh, this is an interesting experiment to make. What's the effect of thinking of 3 things that happened today that I'm grateful for? Simple things, you know? That's the intentionality. It's not going to happen just from my past conditioning. I have to say, okay, I'm willing to move out of that rut or that habitual groove to see what happens when I do this instead. And, or in addition to, maybe you could write a list of things to complain about and write a list of things to be grateful for. I don't know how that would work. You know, but it's not a strained effortful in the sense of, you know, over-efforting, almost violent effort, like I've got to pretend everything was great. You know, nothing went wrong. There was no pain. There was no conflict today. It's not like that. But because that pain and conflict may so readily be for us the only thing we recollect at the end of the day, let's see what happens when we also do this. So that's the stretch of all these different kinds of practices. Because we can be so out of touch with what we do have, and there's so much emphasis in the entire culture in terms of thinking about what we don't have and what we need to buy, what we need to get in order to be a complete or fulfilled human being. We also need to challenge all of that. That's one of the things that Gratitude Journal does. It brings us back in touch with what we do have, which isn't necessarily going to be the obvious, most automatic reflection we have at the end of the day. It's more like, wow, you know, I do need a bigger apartment in New York, and how am I going to get it? And if I only had it, then I could hang that painting, and, you know, of course I don't own the painting, but maybe I could buy the painting, and then, wow, it's really too bad, you know, in New York they're making even smaller apartments, it's ridiculous, I need a bigger apartment, but I can't afford a bigger apartment, but, you know, maybe if I buy that painting and then I sell it, and I sell it at a profit, then maybe I could have a bigger apartment, and, you know, we can spend like our entire time just in that state. I don't have what I need. And there's every message reinforcing that, right, coming from the outside. And so this is the effort that we make. So look at what we do have. Look at what we have to be grateful for. Remember impermanence. All of that will help build a platform for the flourishing of sympathetic joy, of actually being happy for the happiness of others. It's a good challenge. Sympathetic joy is, like the other two, is a practice of generosity. It's real generosity, you can tell. You know, it's like, because it feels so bad when someone seems to feel threatened by your joy, it is a tremendous gift to actually be happy for someone. Even if, you know, and that doesn't mean losing intelligence. People often ask that, what if somebody makes a ton of money causing a lot of harm in this world? Am I supposed to be happy for them? And no, that's not the point. The point is to, you know, not to lose intelligence and discernment, but to look at our own resistance and to see how alone it makes us feel and how unhappy it makes us feel. And to realize, I mean, sometimes somebody's happy not in a way that's causing harm, but not in the way we think they should be living, you know? And so we resent it. I sometimes tell the story. I went to India in the late 80s, very late 80s, or early 90s, with a group of people, and we were visiting different teachers, India and Nepal. And it was just this whole group of people, one of whom was a young man. And then we came back, and at one point he said to me, you know, there was one particular stop we made in a city in India, and we went to see this guru. And so this young man said to me, I want to go back to India and I want to bring my father, who's never done anything like spiritual or meditative in his life. I want to bring him to meet that particular guru in that town. What do you think? So I thought about it and I said, you know, I don't think it's a really good idea. I mean, India has so many beautiful places and that is not one of them. You know, it's really not a very nice city, and it's going to be hot, and he might get sick, and probably won't like the food, and And there's, you know, and let's face it, you know, the scene around the guru is kind of weird. You know, it's a very intense scene. And I said, it's sort of weird. I'll probably turn him off this kind of thing forever. You know, don't do it. So he didn't listen to me. And he brought his father to India to meet that particular teacher in that particular city. I ran into him later, and I said, oh, how was it? And he said, it was the best thing I've ever done in my entire life. My father loved India. He loved the town in India. He loved the food in India. He loved everything about India. And not only that, he loved the guru. And not only that, he became a disciple of the guru. And not only that, he's decided to devote the entire rest of his life to promulgating the guru's teaching. And I thought, I could not have been more wrong. So where am I going to go from here? Am I going to be happy for them? Even though it was so different from what I had predicted? Am I just going to let go of, like, they should have listened to me, you know? And I shouldn't have been that way. And it's not going to last, you know? And just be happy for them, right? There's nothing to do with me. So there's so many moments like that where we actually have a kind of choice. Am I going to hold on to my view about how you should be living and what should be making you happy? Am I just going to let go and be happy for you? Which is an act of generosity. It's made more complex also because of our cultural conditioning, which so often says you will feel better about yourself by putting other people down. It's in so many ways, it's like a culture of disparagement, which we're taught. And we need to get over that. You know, we need to see through that and realize, you know, it's not like sickly sweet to compliment somebody or to look at what's good, even if you're then going to have a critique in some way. I have somebody told me that Auden, it's still something I'm trying to source, the poet Auden was writing theater critiques at one point, and he said somewhere that he wouldn't write a negative review about something if he didn't like it. He just wouldn't review it. He's, as he put it, because art has enough enemies. And I remember I sometimes tell the story about Sylvia and I, who seems to be very present with me here, in this retreat. Sylvia and I were watching, the Winter Olympics once at my house in Barrie, and this couple, you know, this pair of people got up and did this intricate dance on ice. And it's like the instant they were done, the commentator kind of barked out, "Lacks artistry." And Sylvia and I were both like rolling on the floor. It was like, they're dancing on ice. It's not that easy, you know? Could you give them a moment? Like, and then, you know, have a kind of reasoned critique or something? But it was like, eh, no good. And so many ways, you know, we're taught to feel better about ourselves if we can do that. You know, it's a culture of disparagement, of cynicism, putting others down. And so we have to counter that as well. And look for the good. Not in a way, you know, that's unreasoned or stupid or not able to see the flaws in something, but for that link, you know, so that if we're looking critically, it's more of a sense of togetherness rather than, oh, you're so bad, but way over there and I am so great. So it's quite a fascinating journey, the process of deepening more and more sympathetic joy. So do you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about? And then we'll do some walking meditation, which again I'll give some instruction for. I don't know if we have a microphone somewhere. We do.